1 Corinthians 1:18 to 2:16, He Who is Spiritual. The 10th talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits was presented by Ron Julian on December 2, 1997, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Well, tonight's passage has, I think, some very important things to say about spirituality, about what it means to be a spiritual person, at least the way the Bible uses the term. The word gets kicked around a lot. In our culture, it seems as if to be a religious person is not necessarily a valued quality, but to be a spiritual person is. What I'm concerned with is, what does a biblical author like Paul mean when he uses a word like that? That's what we're going to be looking at in the passage that we're talking about tonight. I think this passage is a very important one for seeing what, certainly what Paul's conception of spirituality was. Not that it's everything that he had to say about it, but I would argue that this is one of the most important things that he had to say about it. Now, I need to admit to you right up front that this is a complicated passage. There's a lot to talk about here. This is one of those situations where if I just go in and sort of grab a verse and start hammering on it, I'm very likely to go wrong. I'm very likely to miss the point. I really need to understand, when I come to a book like 1 Corinthians, which is what we're going to be looking at tonight, that this is a letter that Paul wrote to a particular set of people who had a particular set of problems, and this is his interaction with that set of problems. And if I just start grabbing verses and applying them like crazy, I'm very likely to misunderstand what it is that Paul was talking about. So, in order to do this, we're going to have to talk some about the background of this letter. We're going to have to look at the overall context. We're going to have to try to find the flow of thought through the letter. And I just admit to you up front, I mean, it kind of depends on where you're coming from and whether you're used to doing this sort of thing or not. But the fact is that it can be sort of an exercise in frustration, in that here you are, you're coming to hear me give this talk about, you know, what does the Bible have to say about spirituality? And I don't know that the word spirituality is going to even enter into it for at least the first half of what we have to talk about. So, you know, what is this all about? Why are you doing this to us, you might want to ask. And I will answer that question in advance. Why am I doing this to you? My understanding of the goal that we have here, my goal at any rate, is to understand the ideas that Paul had in his head. He had some ideas that he was trying to communicate to the Corinthians, and the only way I'm going to be able to get at those ideas is if that I follow his thinking, if I understand what he's talking about and what it is he says to them. So I think that's an important exercise. It's an important exercise for understanding any book, and the Bible is no different in this sense. Is I want to know what it was that the author was saying and not just make up something that I would like it to be saying. So we're going to try to follow this through. I'm going to have to kind of skim over some parts of this to kind of give you an overall picture. There are a lot of details. The letter that we're going to be looking at here has a lot going on in it. But I do just want to tell you up front that we are going to talk about Paul's conception of spirituality by the time we get done, I hope. But I hope you understand why it is we're starting where we are. I mean, I would like to argue at the end that if I have anything to say about spirituality here, I would like to argue that it is something like what Paul was saying. And if it isn't something like what Paul was saying, how are you going to know that except to look carefully at what it was that he argued and come back at me and say, no, that's not what he was saying. He was saying this. To come back at me and say, well, I'd like him to be saying something else is, from my perspective, not a very helpful observation. It may be comforting to you, but it's not going to go very far with me. But if you were to come along and say, well, no, but Ron, I don't think that could be true because look at what he says over here. Now we have something to talk about. Now, the first step in dealing with the Bible, like with any other book, is trying to come to terms with what is it actually talking about. So that's what I'm going to try to spend some time working with you tonight on this passage. And like I say, there's a lot to it. I hope that I succeed in giving you at least a general understanding of what I think the argument is in this section. There are a lot of details, and I hope that I don't totally lose you. Okay, let's start talking about the background to this letter, because this is important, I think, to understand what's going on. And here, I'm just going to, for just 1 minute, if you can't see this very well, I'm only just going to use it for a minute. It's the map here. You can see we have the Mediterranean Sea here. Judea is over on the this side of the Mediterranean Sea. We have up here, I believe, is the area where Paul was from originally. What we need to know about the time that we're looking at, when Paul became a Christian and first started ministering to other believers, he was called to this city here of Antioch. From there, that was his base of operations. From there, he made several trips out into the Mediterranean region, evangelizing, founding churches. So the first time his trip kind of took him out here and around into this area. In his second missionary journey, he came out here into Ephesus and Troas up here and made the big leap across the Aegean and over into Macedonia and down into Greece. And it's down here where the city of Corinth is, where Paul went, preached the gospel, founded a church. He stayed there in Corinth for a year and a half. When he left, after a year and a half, he crossed over here to Ephesus and then went back to, he may have gone right to Antioch. He may have gone to Jerusalem and then up to Antioch. But after he went to Ephesus, he met with Priscilla and Aquila, two believers who were prominent at the time. They hooked up with a guy named Apollos. Well, Apollos, we're told in Acts, was a powerful speaker. He was a great debater. He was always sort of taking on the Jewish unbelievers and demonstrating to them from the Old Testament that Jesus was the Messiah. So this is kind of an impressive guy, and Aquila and Priscilla picked up on him, and they encouraged him to go across over to Corinth after Paul had left. So if you see the situation we've got, Paul founded the church, he was there for a year and a half, he left, and then Apollos went over. Apollos, who, as I said, was known as to be eloquent, a powerful debater, someone who understood the scriptures and who could refute arguments that other people made and so on. Paul starts on another journey and makes his way around and ends up for a couple of years here in Ephesus. So he's across the Aegean Sea here from Corinth. And while he's there, he finds out about some problems that are going on in Corinth. Now, I want to make it clear that Apollos, we don't have any reason to think that Apollos was doing anything particularly wrong, but what had happened was that numbers of people in Corinth were starting to decide that they really didn't care much for Paul, but they liked Apollos. It's important to realize this contrast that they would make. Apollos, as I said, eloquent, powerful debater, and so on. We know that many of the Corinthians thought that Paul was basically kind of a wimp, that he was unimpressive as a speaker. In fact, in the second letter that we have of Paul's that he wrote to the Corinthians, we see him writing to them and saying, "For they say his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible." That's Paul describing what the Corinthians say about himself. His personal presence is unimpressive and his speech is contemptible. "Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also in deed when present." And he also, actually in that section, defends himself as an apostle. Evidently the people that were sort of the ringleaders of the anti-Paul group were going so far as to deny the authenticity of his apostleship at all. We really don't have to listen to Paul because Paul clearly doesn't have it together. Now, Apollos, we like Apollos, they're saying. He's impressive. Boy, we love it when he gets up there and, you know, he starts debating and he's knocking them over. We think that's great. But Paul, I mean, he's always talking about Jesus and always talking about the cross. And gosh, I mean, say something interesting, will you? That's essentially what the situation is that Paul is writing into. So Paul is planning to make his way to Corinth. But before he does, he writes to them and wants to talk to them about this problem that we have heard about. As I said, I don't think that Apollos was the ringleader of this. Well, we know that he wasn't. And it wasn't really his intention to cause this problem. In fact, we know that at the time this letter is written, that Apollos is not in Corinth anymore. He is with Paul. So he's there. He probably reads this letter that Paul writes before he even sends it to the Corinthians. So Paul and Apollos are on fine terms. I mean, things are fine there. But the issue is this problem that has arisen where there are factions in the church, where there are people who have actually essentially said, we don't want to have anything to do with Paul. We want to follow Apollos. And there are some other factions as well. But as we look at the letter to the Corinthians, it becomes clear that the main division is centered around a group that has identified themselves with Apollos over against Paul. Now, as the letter starts out, Paul exhorts them to be united, to be of the same mind, to stop having these factions. And so sometimes this section of 1 Corinthians is presented as if the issue is Paul is concerned that the Corinthians are not getting along with each other, and he's writing to make sure that they stop fighting and that they start getting along with each other. That is probably not a very accurate way of describing what's going on. I don't want to say that Paul is not concerned that they get along. He is concerned that they get along, but what is more concerning to him is why they're not getting along. What kind of thinking has led to these factions in the first place? Maybe think about it like this. Would Paul be happy if the Corinthians wrote back to him and said, "You're right, we need to be getting along, and so we have all come together, we have all become of one mind, now we all agree that you're a poor excuse for an apostle. So you'll be happy to know that there are no factions anymore, we're all in agreement." That would not be what Paul was trying to accomplish. His concern is not just that they're not getting along, but that the divisions reflect a wrong way of thinking about the gospel. And to him, that's more important. It's that prior, what do I think is true? What do I value? That leads to the various ways I behave. That's what he's concerned with in this account. It's not just concern about the fact that they're not getting along, but what it is that has led to that. And we'll see this as we go along. Paul's concern is that there seems to be a real spiritual blindness on the part of many of the people that he's writing to in Corinth, that they would look at him and his ministry and reject it as being foolish and unwise. What is it that has led someone to make that kind of assessment? And you can see the kind of tightrope that Paul has to walk here, and we see this in the Corinthian letters, in 1 Corinthians and in 2 Corinthians, because on the one hand, Paul doesn't want to defend himself. This is not a letter of personal outrage. Why don't you guys like me? He's not trying to say, I'm such a good guy, so you really ought to follow everything I say. He's trying to downplay himself and say, I'm not a big deal. But Paul is arguing that he has an authority that has been given to him by Jesus, that he is an apostle, one who has been delegated to go out and proclaim a certain message. And so to reject him and to say he is foolish is to say that the message of the gospel is foolish. And that's a serious problem from his perspective. So he's sort of trying to do this balancing act where on the one hand he's not trying to make a big deal out of himself, but yet on the other hand he is making a big deal out of himself because he sees himself as being one who has been given a unique role. So all through the letters to the Corinthians you see Paul trying to make this balance. You know, the classic statement of it is in 2 Corinthians, not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves. He's saying, I'm not saying that I'm a big deal or that I figured everything out or I'm a real smart guy or anything like that. What I'm saying is that God has commissioned me, has given me a message, and this is the message that he's given me. That's what I'm saying. So, first part we want to look at, and we're going to kind of skim over this stuff because we're really interested in kind of the last part of chapter 2. But we want to kind of try to see the whole picture. In verse 18 of chapter 1, let me read a little bit of what we have here. For the word of the cross is to those who are perishing foolishness, but to us who are being saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed Jews ask for signs, and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Well, what's going on here? Some of this language sounds a little strange. First of all, why is he talking about this at all? Why did he, in the middle of a discussion about you guys need to stop fighting over I'm with Paul and I'm with Apollos, why does he go into a discussion about the wisdom of the world versus the wisdom of the gospel, the wisdom of the cross? Well, notice verse 17, which leads into this section. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech, that the cross of Christ should not be made void. The issue here for Paul is he is defending how he speaks and how he teaches. He is being charged by some of the Corinthians with being unwise, and they have a certain perspective on what wisdom would look like and what it would sound like. And so what he's saying is, Christ didn't send me to preach, and literally it's in wisdom of speech. He's saying, you guys have a certain conception of what wisdom would look like, but I'm not really concerned to meet your expectations, because that's not what Christ sent me to do. He sent me to proclaim a message that the world finds foolish. And it doesn't bother me that the world finds it foolish, that I don't meet the world's standard of wisdom, because, frankly, and then this is what his discussion is, God is not all that impressed with the wisdom of the world. Now, what's he getting at here? What is this contrast? essentially what Paul is laying out here is that God doesn't care whether the world around us thinks the gospel is wise or not. He says the wisdom of the world is foolishness because through its wisdom it did not come to know God. You see, there is wisdom in the world. I mean, there is knowledge and understanding. There are people who understand a lot of different things. Now, that can be pretty impressive, to know and understand how things work in the world, or to have an insight into human nature and to be able to figure out what makes people tick, or to be able to have insight into economics, say, and the way money is handled, and to be able to make your way in the world and amass a fortune and always seem to know what to do to make it grow and grow. All of those kinds of things are impressive, and it represents a certain kind of wisdom. I mean, there is knowledge and understanding there. But when you add it all up, what we in this world have come to understand through that wisdom really doesn't amount to much, because in the end we have missed the most important part. We've missed God. We have not come to understand God through our wisdom. Paul is saying that the gospel that he preaches, this revelation from God about what life is about what human life is about his promises and his plans for humanity, that gospel is true wisdom. It's a story that, when embraced and believed, will lead to eternal life. So, what Paul is trying to get across to them is, look, you may use the standard of your culture to evaluate the way I talk and say, Paul is not an impressive speaker. What he has to say really isn't very interesting to us. But he says, you're using the wrong standard to make this assessment. You're using a standard of what wisdom is that God himself looks at and says, I'm not really very impressed with it. Because if you use the set of assumptions that the world around you has put together to try to make sense out of life, you take that set of assumptions and you use it to evaluate the gospel, he says, you're going to miss it. You're going to look at the gospel and you're going to see it as foolishness. What good is a set of assumptions that are so off base that when you look at the most fundamental truths of life, you look at them and say, oh no, by my standards, that's foolish. What good is that? There are these two options. Either God is going to come to the world and he's going to make a case that presents itself as being wise in the terms that the world would understand as wise. But Paul's saying, no, that's not the option God took. His message is not wise in the way that the world around us thinks that things are wise, and it doesn't bother him that it's not that way. So why is Paul saying this? He's saying this to indicate to them, it doesn't bother me that by your worldly criteria, what I'm saying isn't wise. That's the way it would have to be. You think about it the way the world around you thinks about it, and what I'm saying is not going to seem wise to you. But in fact, what I'm saying is true. So there's something wrong here somewhere. A wisdom that has you looking at the truth and missing it is not very wise. Now, what's just a real quick comment here. Paul is not saying that the gospel is irrational or nonsensical. When he's comparing the wisdom of the world and the foolishness of God and all of this kind of stuff, he's not saying that God doesn't care about things that are wise and make sense. He likes things that are irrational and foolish. That's not what he's saying. The words foolish and wise here, you have to see them as being kind of in quotes. What he's saying is that God is content to preach a message that a hard, unbelieving heart would find as foolish. It doesn't concern him that his message is perceived in the world as foolish. He's not saying it is foolish. He's not saying that it doesn't make sense. He's not saying that it's not true. He's not saying that it can't be examined and looked at and seen to make sense. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is when what he's going to call the natural man looks at the message of the gospel, what he finds there is uninteresting, uncompelling to him, and thus looks unwise. That's the thing that he's saying. In the world that we live in, If you take someone like Carl Sagan, Carl Sagan is, especially now that he has died, death is the great... this is how you achieve secular sainthood in our culture, is by dying. So Carl has become a very popular figure here recently because of his departure. But he has been perceived for some time in our culture as being someone who's really wise, that we should listen to his pronouncements on religion and ethics and so on, because he's done a lot of studying about the planet Saturn. Why is it that we think that Carl Sagan is someone that we ought to listen to about those things? Well, I would say that the world around us perceives him as being a wise person because his assumptions fit very well with the assumptions that most of the people in our culture are making. When he describes Christianity as a pre-scientific superstition, which is unnecessary for an intelligent person to embrace because science has explained everything that we need to know about everything, we don't find the people in our culture rising up and saying, now, wait a minute, Carl, there are a lot of philosophical problems that you haven't dealt with at all there. I mean, you're kind of, you know, you've swept a whole bunch of stuff under the rug. Let's start talking about, I mean, no. And we all sort of nod our heads and say, oh, yeah, yeah, well, that's right. You can see, in our culture, he's perceived of as a wise man, and his analysis of Christianity is it is foolishness. Only, I mean, to the end, when you hear him talking about Christianity, he still can't really even comprehend how anybody who has an ounce of sense could be a Christian. I mean, you know, I've already explained to you about how we just made up God because we didn't know, you know, about how the sun was made up of hydrogen and various things. I mean, you know, now that we know these things, we don't need the story about God anymore. Well, we're looking at a battle of worldviews. Given a certain set of presumptions and assumptions and understanding about what is true, this group looks at this group, each group looks at the other and says, what you're saying is unwise, it's foolish, it doesn't make any sense. Where do you have to go to ultimately decide where the wisdom and where the folly is? You have to go back to those assumptions and ask which are the ones that are founded in reality and which ones aren't. What Paul's saying is the assumptions that lead one to embrace the gospel are assumptions that are grounded in reality. God is there. He has promised what he has promised. The promises that he has made answer the questions that we have as human beings about our life in a way that the competition does not. So, why is Paul saying all this stuff then? Why is he talking about the wisdom of the world and making this comparison between these two perspectives? It's because the Corinthians have challenged the way he talks. Essentially what they've said is, in our culture, we have come to understand what wise, profound thinking looks and sounds like. And when Apollos gets up and he's up there thumping and pounding on the lectern and embarrassing all of those Jews and showing that Jesus is the Messiah, now that's what it's supposed to look like. And I think, maybe this is too simplistic, but I think that for a Greek culture like the Corinthians, this understanding would have been grounded in some models that they would have had about what good speaking looked like. Groups like the Sophists, who had been around for a long time, where the goal, as I understand it, really was to speak with eloquence and to cut down any opposition. I mean, the debate is the height of rhetorical excellence. And if you can leave the competition, you know, decimated and do it with elegance and style, then you're wise. That's what a good speaker ought to sound like. That's not what Paul's doing. He's just coming and giving the message that he was given. Jesus is the Messiah. He died and rose again for our sins. If we believe in him as our Savior, we will find eternal life. We will find forgiveness for the sins that we have committed. We will be freed from our guilt, freed from our sin, freed from death, That's the message that Paul kept talking about. And that's the message that ultimately people started to say, Paul, you're sounding like a broken record. Why don't you, you know, say something with some style? And ultimately they got tired of him. Okay. Now I want to jump now to verse 6 of chapter 2. Paul goes on to say some other things about how I didn't come to you with superiority of speech or of wisdom. I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified, and so on. More talk about what he had to say, how he spoke. And if you don't understand that that's the issue, you're going to miss everything in the first, like, four chapters of 1 Corinthians. Because the issue is the Corinthians are challenging the way Paul speaks. They're saying, we think you are unimpressive. We don't even think you're an apostle. We don't like listening to you. We don't like what you have to say. We like Apollos. Now, there's a guy that we can go with. And this is some of the group. So, obviously, there are some of the Corinthians who are happy with Paul and not responding to him this way. But there is a subset of them who have set themselves up against Paul and his apostleship. Now, in the section that we're going to concentrate on here now, where we're going to look at some of these issues of spirituality, Paul is going to talk some more about the wisdom of what it is he has to say. We're starting in verse 6. Yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature. A wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age, who are passing away. The wisdom that Paul speaks, he says, I do speak wisdom. Those who are mature understand that what I am saying is wise, that it really is true and profoundly true. But the wisdom that I have to proclaim is not of this age, he's saying. What he has to proclaim is the gospel, which is a message that says essentially this age is broken beyond repair. You need to be redeemed from it. You need to be rescued from the problem of guilt and the problem of sin. And you need to be redeemed into an eternal life in an age to come where God is going to rebuild essentially the heavens and the earth and rule through Jesus over all of creation and make everything the way it ought to be. This new age, not anything to do with the new age movement that we're familiar with, but the Bible does talk about a new age where the hope of mankind is to be found. So the wisdom that I have is not the wisdom of this age. It's not really going to make this age work for you, and this age is not going to find it particularly attractive. It is a wisdom that has to do with the next age. The rulers of this age, the movers and shakers of this age, the ones who have set the standards, the ones that you Corinthians are so concerned about, you know, what would the movers and shakers of my time think about someone like Paul? Oh, you know, naive, hick, unsophisticated, we're not interested. Saying the rulers of this age missed the wisdom of the gospel. But he says, we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory. By mystery, it's the same as when he says the hidden wisdom. What he means essentially is, look, God himself has known what this whole story is about. He knows his own mind. He knows why he created the world, where he is taking the world. He knows what the whole story is about. But he has kept his own counsel about it for a long time. Well, the fact is that in the gospel, God has made some incredibly important statements about what the whole story is about. And Paul is a representative of that gospel. We couldn't have known this on our own, but now God has revealed his purposes and explained what Jesus has to do with those purposes and where the cross fits into that and what the point of human life is all about. I mean, God has come along and told us a whole series of things that we wouldn't have known if he hadn't told us. And who are those who've told us those things? Well, one of the important people who has told us these hidden things, the things that God had not let us know before. Paul is one of the important people who has passed those things on. He is, as he's going to describe later on, a steward of the mysteries of God. He has been entrusted with an understanding of God's purposes, and his job is not to go out and make up a bunch of new stuff for people to find interesting. His job is to take the information with which he has been entrusted and tell other people. He's a steward. God told him, and he goes out and tells everybody else. This wisdom, he says, is the wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood. For if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But just as it is written, things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard and which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love him. So, in this section, Paul's talking about what he calls the true wisdom. I do speak wisdom. It is a wisdom that comes from God himself. It is a knowledge about the eternal purposes of the ages that only God himself knew, and he entrusted those truths, among other people, to me, to Paul. And my job is to go out and tell them. One of the most important phrases in this whole section is what he keeps saying, we speak. Because, again, you're not going to understand this passage if you don't keep in mind that Paul's topic is the way he speaks. What about this message? What about, Paul, you were there for a year and a half. Why is it that we find you so unimpressive, Paul? That's the topic. What he's saying is, well, the mature find what I speak very wise. They recognize the wisdom of what it is that I have to say. We speak wisdom, he says. Now, one of the really important things for us to notice is that Paul uses the word we. This is important because it's going to show up a bunch as we go down through the rest of this. Paul sometimes, and we could talk about what the reasons are, there are various possible explanations, but sometimes Paul uses the word we when he's talking about himself. He means essentially I. When he says, we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, he means I speak wisdom among those who are mature. The issue is Paul. How does Paul speak? And what he's saying is, look, when I'm among the mature, I do speak wisdom. I'm not saying that what I have to say is foolish. It's foolish by your standards, but not by my standards. And I would say by the standards of God, what I have to say is not foolishness, it is wisdom. But he uses the word we, and that's going to be important as we follow this through. So, Paul is right in the thick of his discussion about how he talks, the wisdom of his message, why his message ought to be heeded. So how can he be so confident that he speaks true wisdom? Well, his claim is that the Spirit of God has revealed these mysteries to him. And so he says, for to us, God revealed them through the Spirit. Now who's the us here? This is Paul again. What he's saying is the Spirit of God has revealed to me the mysteries that I'm talking about, the mysteries about the coming age and what his purposes are, God has entrusted those ideas to me. Like I say, in chapter 4, he describes himself as a steward of the mysteries of God. God has entrusted, has given them into his care. So, to us, God revealed them through the Spirit, for the Spirit searches all things, even the depths of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. There's a lot that we could talk about in that sentence that I don't want to talk about right now. For our purposes, we want to concentrate on what his main point is. What's he getting at here? How are you going to get at? Paul is talking about truths about reality that are in the very mind of God. How am I going to get at that? Am I going to force it out of him? Am I going to blackmail God somehow? God, if you don't tell me what I want to know, I'll... What? There's not much that I can do to God. the thoughts of God, they're hidden in the recesses of who God is. Paul is saying that the Spirit of God himself has revealed to Paul these truths about reality. I mean, it's a very audacious claim. You have to understand how radical and really incredible this claim is that Paul is making. He's saying, the Spirit of the living God has come to me and told me the very thoughts of God himself. Things that nobody could have gotten at, because God knows them, and if he doesn't tell us, we'll never know. The Spirit of God has told me those things. Not that he's told him everything, but he's told him these mysteries, these things about the coming age that I never would have known if God hadn't told us. Now we have received not the Spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit. Notice again, the issue is Paul's speech. How does he speak? When Paul is talking and the Corinthians are listening to him and thinking that he sounds so unimpressive, what is it that he's speaking? What he's saying is, I am speaking the things that have been imparted to me by the Spirit of God. The mysteries of God, the things that you never could have figured out in 1,000 years, I'm telling you because God's Spirit told me. That's Paul's claim for what it is he has to say. Now, the New American Standard ends that little section with Paul saying, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. And that, I'm not sure that's the best way to translate that. We have a translation problem here. And I'd say there are a couple of possibilities. There are several more than I'm going to look at, but there's a couple here. Explaining spiritual things to spiritual ones is one possibility. We have three words. Somethinging spirituals. That's what we have in Greek. In New American Standard, it says spiritual, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. The word thoughts isn't in there. The word words isn't in there. We just have something spiritual to spiritual, or something spirituals with spirituals, or something like that. Two of the best possibilities are that it's that, or else it's the one that the New American Standard went for, combining spiritual things with spiritual things. And then we have to decide what would the things be, and the New American Standard has put in thoughts and words for the things. Very obviously a very cryptic statement. I mean, we don't have a lot to go on here. Nonetheless, I'm very much strongly inclined to see this as the preferable way of translating it, because this is exactly a summation of what Paul has just said and what he's about to say. Because he's saying the spiritual things that the things that he has to say, the things that he explains, are things that have been given to him by the Spirit. And what is he about to talk about? He's about to talk about the spiritual person as the one who can understand and appreciate and embrace the spiritual things that he teaches. So this is kind of sums up the section that we're looking at. Paul describes himself as one who explains spiritual things to spiritual people. That is, things given by the Spirit to those who have been taught by the Spirit. And that's essentially what this section that we're looking at is about. So, if he says that he explains things given to him by the Spirit to spiritual people, then what does he mean by spiritual people? What is that all about? Well, he explains that. He says, but a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. The natural man, and what I understand him to be saying here, he's talking about what we are apart from the work of the Spirit of God. This is a very common dichotomy for Paul, to distinguish between the flesh and the spirit, not the flesh and my spirit, but what I am apart from the influence of the Spirit of God, and then what I am under the influence of the Spirit of God. The natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. And he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. To appraise, the idea here, I think, is to evaluate correctly. In other words, the spiritual person is the one who will look at the gospel that Paul preaches, will see the truth of it, will embrace it as true, so thus will appraise it and say, that's good, Paul, that's right, that's wise, that's the truth, that's what I'm going to believe. That's what the spiritual person does. He appraises things correctly. The natural man, the one apart from the Spirit of God, looks at the wisdom of God and sees it as foolishness. This is what Paul's been talking about all along, is this problem of there is the wisdom of the world and the wisdom of God. The gospel is the wisdom of God. The natural man is the one who looks at the gospel and says, no, I don't see anything there for me. What's distinctive about this section is that Paul is attributing the difference between them to the work of the Spirit of God. It is the natural man, the person, what the person is by nature, apart from the spiritual influence of the Holy Spirit. It is that person who looks at the gospel and sees foolishness. It is the person who is spiritual, the one who is under the influence of the Spirit of God, who looks at the message of the gospel and sees wisdom. He who is spiritual, he says, appraises all things, yet he himself is appraised by no man. The spiritual person is the one who can look at and evaluate things for what they are, especially the gospel in his in what he's talking about here. Why is Paul saying all of this stuff to them? Because they're in a very serious situation. These are people who are looking at the Apostle Paul and his message, and they're sitting back and saying, I'm bored, I don't get it, this doesn't seem very interesting to me. I mean, yeah, you know, Paul, we heard you say that Jesus was the Messiah, and we buy that idea, that's fine, you know, great. But, you know, what you have to say is just not wise. It's not worth listening to. Get off the stage and let somebody talk who knows how to talk. I mean, that's what they're saying. Paul's saying, there's something profoundly wrong here. Because, as he says, it is the spiritual person, the person in whom the work of the Spirit of God has come to fruition, that can ultimately look at the gospel and see it as wise. You're looking at my proclamation and calling it foolishness. This is an incredibly serious problem that you have. At the moment, you're not acting like believers, but like people who do not have the Spirit of God at work in them. They're looking at the messenger from God, Paul, and calling him a fool. I mean, how much worse can it get? He says the spiritual person is appraised by no man. And what makes the most sense to me at this point is that he's really now talking about his personal relationship with them. When he says the spiritual person is appraised by no man, what he's saying is the person who is spiritual, the one who has come to see the wisdom of the truths of God through the work of the Spirit of God, that person understands what he looks at. He looks at the gospel and he sees truth. But when the natural man looks at him, he doesn't get him. He looks at him and says, this doesn't make any sense to me. That guy doesn't make any sense to me. And I think the reason that Paul is saying this is because that's the very situation that's happening here in Corinth. The Corinthians are looking at him and he's not making any sense to them. They see him as being unimpressive. They see him as not even being an apostle. In other words, not only are the Corinthians showing their unspirituality by their rejection of the gospel, but they're showing their unspirituality by their misunderstanding of Paul and his speech and their misappraisal of what they have in him as a person is another indication of the lack of spirituality in their current experience. Now, he concludes by saying, "For who has known the mind of the Lord that he should instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ." Okay, we have a quote from the Old Testament. Basically, no one is in a position to second-guess God and tell him what to do, because nobody knows what God's thinking. Who am I to come along and tell God, "No, no, no, that's not the way it ought to be. It ought to be like this." Who has known the mind of the Lord that he should instruct him? Who can come along and say, "I know how it's all working, God, so you ought to do it like this"? The whole problem is, we don't know. We don't know what God knows about his purposes, so we're not in any position to come along and instruct him. But, Paul says, we have the mind of Christ. Now, who is we in this situation? I would argue that we're still back in that same we that Paul was using up above. He means himself. And what does he mean by having the mind of Christ? He's already described this for us. We know what he's talking about. It's this access to the hidden wisdom. It's the thoughts of God that no one but the Spirit of God knows. He's already talked about God and his thoughts and how God's very thoughts... I mean, let's not go overboard here, but what God knows about what is true and what his purposes are and what his plans and promises are, those truths hidden in the mind of God have been given to Paul through the work of the Spirit. So in other words, Paul's saying, the natural man, nobody can come along and tell God what to do because he doesn't know what God's thinking or what's going on. But the fact is that I do know what God's thinking and what God's purposes are, because that's what I've been given. That's my job, is to proclaim to the world, this is what God's thinking, because he told me. So when he says we have the mind of Christ, what he's reminding them is, just as mankind in general is in no position to come along and tell God what to do, I think what he's implying here is essentially, you're not in any position to come along and tell me what to do either. Because I have been given a unique role. I know something that you don't, essentially. I have been given the understanding of the purposes of God. It's my job to pass that understanding on. When you come along and say, "Paul, you're doing it all wrong, and you're not speaking wisdom, and you need to change or get off the stage and let somebody else do it," you have no idea what you're talking about. You're just showing your lack of spiritual perception. You're showing that at this point, this combination, spirit-inspired words and a spirit-inspired understanding of those words, that's not working in your life. That is not what's happening in the lives of my critics. Now, is he saying that they're not believers? That's a topic for another time, but I would just answer, no, I don't think necessarily he's saying that. But he's raising the question of whether they are. The issue is, what has led to this incredible foolishness on their part? And in the end, time is going to tell what has led to it. I think as he goes on later in the letter, we can kind of see some of that. But he's raising a very serious issue about the spirituality of the Corinthians. There is no bigger mark of the work of the Spirit of God in someone's life than that they understand the gospel and see it as truth, as profound truth, and embrace it. Okay, so really quickly then, I want to draw a couple of conclusions from what I've been saying here. I know this is a complicated passage, and I'm sure for those of you that stay, you may have some questions that you want to go into. But I would say that one of the important things that arises from this passage, and it's not the only place in Corinthians where it arises as well, the whole chapters 12 and 13 and 14, the same issue shows up, and it's very important to understand there as well. There is this distinction in the operation of the Spirit of God that we need to see at work in what Paul is saying. On the one hand, there are specific works that the Spirit does in the lives of individuals that he may not do in the lives of other individuals. And one of those examples is that he has inspired an understanding of the purposes of God in the Apostle Paul. I am not an apostle. You are not an apostle. What Paul had, I don't have, and you don't have. So when he talks about the Spirit having shown to him these hidden mysteries of God, this is not something that the Spirit does for me. I can't come to you and say, the Spirit of God has come to me and revealed what God's purposes are. I understand them. I know what they're all about. And you had better listen to me because I have got it right. I can't do that. And if I were to do that, I would encourage you not to listen to me because I would be wrong. It's not true. So there is this individual work of the Spirit, which Paul describes later on in terms of, you know, not all are apostles, are they? Not all are prophets, are they? Not all are X, Y, and Z. There are all sorts of things that the Spirit does in the lives of various people that there is no promise, no guarantee that the Spirit of God is going to do those things in everybody's life. I don't think there are going to be any more apostles. It sure looks that way if you put the whole picture together. I'm certainly not one. I don't think I'm a prophet. So that kind of work of the Spirit is a work that is individual and not to be expected necessarily in the life of everyone. On the other hand, though, we see that there is a general work of the Spirit, a work of the Spirit in quickening the understanding, a work of the Spirit in overcoming our reluctance to the truth of the gospel. The natural man looks at the gospel and says it's foolish, but the spiritual man is the one who looks at the gospel and says that's true. Paul says later on that no one says that Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. It's this idea that the Spirit of God is at work, not revealing things to me in the sense that I have these ideas that come into my mind and they are divine revelations and I can come and tell you and say, God has revealed that this is true. But when I confront the divine revelations that he gave to Paul, I look at that and I say, ultimately, I say, that's the truth. That's what I'm going to build my life on. When that kind of result happens in a person's life, when through the course of my life, whatever I may say about, you know, going forward and believing in Jesus or not or whatever, it's that ultimately, where does my life end up? Where do I end up embracing the gospel as true and wise or not? That person is the one who has the mark of the Spirit upon them. That's a spiritual person, because that's a person who can appraise, who can see the correct value of and the importance of and the wisdom of the truths of God, the things that God has revealed. Now, some people may get the feeling that we've sort of, this perspective, you know, I've lost something here. Okay, yeah, so there's this general sort of understanding of the truth, but gosh, I mean, I used to hear teaching about the mind of Christ where this was more like, you know, Jesus was coming and putting ideas in my head, and I like that better. How come I can't have revelation like Paul was having revelation? Well, I would sort of argue back the other way. To me, what we see here is incredibly important because there are two very important things being talked about. And whether they're true or not makes a huge difference in the life of humanity, I would say. One of the things that Paul is saying is that what he has written here, what he has said in the Bible, I had better pay attention to because his understanding of the purposes of God has been given to him as a gift from God himself. Paul makes this statement over and over and over again throughout his writings. I didn't make this up, he says. God told me this. Either he is lying, or he is insane, or it's true. I mean, we have to confirm. This is the claim that Paul is making. He's saying, I didn't get this from men. Jesus himself came to me and explained all this stuff to me, is what he says. So, that picture of the work of the Spirit of God is incredibly important. There's a group of folks this weekend that Jack and I are going to have an informal discussion about the work of the Jesus Seminar, which some of you may have heard of, taking a very critical look at the Gospels and deciding, well, Jesus didn't say this and Jesus didn't say that and so on. Well, one of the central assumptions when you read the stuff of the Jesus Seminar is everybody who said anything about Jesus after Jesus didn't understand anything about what he was doing and got it all wrong. All of the apostles totally corrupted. The original Jesus and his message is hidden and buried within all of the stuff that all of the apostles came along and laid on top of it. Paul is an incredible villain in this scenario because he really, Jesus didn't found Christianity. Jesus was just this sort of Socratic Jewish philosopher who wandered around saying a few groovy things. But it was these ambitious religious types like Paul that came along and really kind of turned it into something. Well, you understand then how important it is, the claim that Paul's making. He's making the claim, I didn't make this up. This is what Jesus told me. So, I mean, you got to make a decision. Which way are you going to go? So that's a very important claim. I mean, to see Paul making that claim makes us understand what it is the Bible is asking me to believe and to either accept or reject. I mean, that's what Christianity is. Anything that would come along and say the apostles missed it, I mean, they just didn't get it, that can't have any sort of claim as calling itself biblical Christianity. It could be an objection to Christianity, but it can't call itself Christianity because Christianity is built on the claim of the apostles that they were given the authority by Jesus himself to say the things that they said. And then the other part, so that's an incredibly important truth. Much more important than, I think, than whether I get messages from God in my head. And then the other truth is an equally important one, that it is God himself who is at work overcoming my natural reluctance to embrace and believe the truths of God. That spirituality is not marked by speaking in tongues or doing miraculous things. I mean, that can be a mark of the Spirit in the way the New Testament describes it. But the one mark that the Spirit always leaves on the life of a person is that ultimately you step back and you look at a person's life, what it all adds up to, and when you ask if they're a spiritual person, the issue is, did they see the truth about God, about the gospel, about themselves? Did they see it and embrace it and call it wisdom? If they did, then they were spiritual. That was the Spirit of God at work in them. And if they didn't, then I don't care what else they did, that was not the Spirit of God at work in what they did. So, two profoundly important pictures of what the Spirit of God does. Telling us through the apostles what we couldn't have known on our own, and teaching, reforming, enlightening us so that we can embrace what otherwise we find repulsive. Not because it doesn't make sense or because it isn't true, but because we don't want it to be true. Okay. I'll stop there. If anybody wants to leave at this point, I ask you to go kind of quietly and quickly so we can continue with the questions. Well, there's a ton of... there's a lot in this passage. I feel badly that I've had to skim over so much and kind of piecemeal it together. So if you have any questions just about, in the first case, like, what in the world did you just say, or something like that, that would be fine. Yeah.
Well, if somebody claims a divine revelation from God, how do we go about knowing how to take it seriously? several years ago I had this vision where a girl who sat on my living room for 5 hours told her that a very extensive cosmology about some underground world and how people went down there when they died and all that. And she absolutely believed she'd been given some kind of gift from and everything. And so, well, when I told that story to another friend of mine, he said, well, how is that different from what the Apostle Paul said or a lot of other Christian saints and so forth? So when someone makes such a claim without receiving the divine revelation, by what means do we determine if we should take it seriously?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I don't know that I have all the answers to that question. I know where, for myself, where I would start. If we kind of take and put ourselves back in the position of the people listening to Jesus and Paul and the apostles and so on, here were people who were claiming to have divine revelation, and I would argue we would have been right if we were in that spot to accept their claim and embrace it. Part of, I think, what I see the Bible as a guide for that kind of stuff for us, I see the Bible pointing to a couple of things. First of all, in the ministry of Jesus and the apostles, it says that God was confirming that he was indeed behind the message of the apostles and of Jesus through the miracles that were done. And we're not talking about secondhand stories about how somebody's asthma cleared up or something like that. I mean, we're talking about, there's a guy, I put him in the tomb, I wrapped him up and stuck him in there, and a couple of days later Jesus says, get out and stand up, arise, and he comes out and he's alive. I mean, the kind of right in your face sort of miracle that attests to the reality of God being behind it. That's one of the things that the Bible points to. That's what Jesus says about the feeding of the 5,000, that he calls it a sign, which was essentially intended to demonstrate that God was in fact behind what it was he was saying. But the other part of it, I think, is even more important, and that is that Jesus and Paul and the other apostles also were making the claim that what they were saying fit with what God had already revealed of himself. I mean, they would have seen the Old Testament as being authoritative. Here's where God has spoken in history and shown us something of himself. What he said in the prophets, they're saying, go and look. We have that very famous statement in Acts about the Bereans and how they were more noble than the Thessalonians, because after Paul talked, they would go and they'd spend the night looking through the Old Testament trying to figure out whether what he said was true. They'd go and actually look at the scriptures and say, does what Paul's saying fit with what we see there? So I think for myself the most important criterion that I would use for anybody making that sort of claim would be, does it fit with what God has already told us about what is true? And then secondarily, I have a hard time at this point believing that God is sending messages through people without the sort of that attesting evidence that he really is behind what was going on. So that's how I would answer it now. I mean, I've talked to people as well who've made claims like that, and at this point my problem with what they say is, number one, that really doesn't fit what I think I have seen in the Bible. So we're going to have to go and look at the Bible, and you're going to have to show me how I could believe that to be true when I seem to see the Bible saying something else. And then also, you know, a lot of people say that they hear messages and voices and all kinds of stuff, but what would make me think that this is the creator of the universe speaking to you in a vision like this? What what has he done to give some sort of attestation that in fact that's the case? Now, if somebody wants to say to me, I don't have a message from God for the world, I'm just convinced that God spoke to me in a dream or something like that, that's really a different kind of thing. I mean, if it's between them and God, I'll leave it to them and God to sort out whether this was God saying something to them or not. It's not really my business. But when somebody comes along and says, I have a vision, I have a message, this is my burden for the world, which God has given me, now you're starting to talk like an apostle. And that's where I go, well, I don't think so. Yes?
I find it very interesting that this argument is really, or what he's trying to defend is really pertinent today. Mm-hmm. I just had a friend tell me that he couldn't believe that a member of our church goes to our church because he can't believe he'd left his previous church because the teaching was so great. And what he meant by that was the teaching was so colorful, it was so descriptive, and it held everybody's attention, it had really good analogies. Whether they applied or not to what the scripture said, it didn't really matter. It was just that you could go to this church and you could be entertained. And that was really powerful to this guy because, to him, that's what sort of eloquence of speech is still a popular thing. Right. And I remember the church that I came out of, and before I came up to Oregon, I was pretty much enamored with the same kinds of things. That there was a preacher there that has gone on to write 4 or 5 books, and they've sold a million copies. Right. And this guy can really speak.
Right.
But whether he has the truth of the gospel or not really doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Well, and of course, one might argue that for someone in my position, it's a very helpful sort of way of understanding the Bible to have it saying that style in the teaching presentation is not the most important thing. I believe it fervently myself.
Based on that, though, my question is how come we couldn't mean people who recognize spiritual things? I mean, give me some reasons why it means I rather than, Paul's talking in the singular, because I don't see anything wrong with taking the we plural based on just sort of the whole argument that people who have been touched with a sort of a spiritual understanding couldn't be a part of that we.
Or, well, it all depends on
like Apollos. Why couldn't Apollos be considered in that we?
Right. If you're talking about the very last statement, we have the mind of Christ?
Well, I want to know why I is more applicable than we throughout. I want to know some of your reasons why you would throw we out.
Right. Well, what I'm arguing is that in the context that Paul, in the argument that Paul's laying out here, the issue is a challenge to the way Paul speaks. It's not a challenge to the way Apollos speaks or the way anybody else speaks. It's a challenge to the way Paul speaks. Like, let me just read a couple of things from around the context. Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in wisdom of speech, that the cross of Christ should not be made void. When I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. My message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not rest on the wisdom of God, men, but on the power of God. Over in chapter 4, here's a good example. Let a man regard us in this manner, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. In this case, moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. But to me it is a very small thing that I should be examined by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even examine myself, for I am conscious of nothing against myself, and so on. Therefore, do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, and so on. Now, I would argue that section in 4 it seems very clear to me. I don't see how we can get around it, that the issue is that the Corinthians have judged Paul. They, as he says, to me it is a very small thing that I should be examined by you or any human court. He sees himself as being under the examination of the Corinthians. And he describes himself, notice how he says, let a man regard us in this manner. He doesn't mean Christians. He's not saying that Christians are the servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. He is a servant of Christ and a steward of the mysteries of God. He is the one who has been given the message, and he is the one who is being analyzed and scrutinized by the Corinthians.
But if he's the one that has to defend himself, he doesn't really have to defend Apollos and Cephas or anybody else. He's just defending himself.
Right.
But when he talks about spiritual mind, I'm saying he could use we for the spiritual part of it, because he agrees that Apollos and these other teachers and stewards of it are also considered in that we, possibly.
Okay, well, but
then when it comes to defending the accusations, then he's speaking maybe more in I.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, yeah, I could imagine a sentence that he could say, we have the mind of Christ. I could construe that along with the other stuff in a way of making sense of it if it was all Christians. But what I'm saying is, I don't think the context takes me in that direction. Because when he starts out and says, but yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, when he says that we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, when he says, we have received not the spirit of the world, which and the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words, or, as I said, explaining spiritual things to spiritual people. That's Paul describing his ministry. What he does is he speaks. See, that's what I'm saying, is that the thread that ties all of this word together, this section together, in a sense, is the word speaks. That Paul is talking about how he speaks. So, I would say that throughout most of that section, the we's have to be Paul. And when we come to that statement where he says, we have the mind of Christ, now, what does having the mind of Christ mean? And I would say what makes the most sense to me at this point is that the mind of Christ is the thing that he has already described in the terms where he says, who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God. Paul has already set up what he's talking about. There are these truths, as he says, mysteries, the hidden wisdom of God, which has been through the Spirit, the understanding of those things has been given to Paul. And having that understanding, then, he speaks them. God shows him, and he speaks it out. So when he says, we have the mind of Christ, I have these two things working together here. I've seen him using we throughout to talk about himself, and I saw him essentially describing himself as a recipient of the mind of God, that God's thoughts, God's hidden understanding of things has been transmitted to Paul. Well, in that very last section, what does he talk about? Who knows God's thoughts? Who can give God advice? Because who knows what he's thinking? Well, Paul's already made the case. I know what God's thinking. Among others, I have been entrusted with the mysteries of God. So when I put all that together, I'm just saying, I think that makes the most sense out of what he's doing. Now, you're right. If I wanted to interpret the mind of Christ a little differently, I could see that we have the mind of Christ. I could say that. We have the mind of Christ, but not the Spirit has given me hidden wisdom and knowledge that I can go and proclaim to people. But I have two things. I have two ways in which I just describe that. I have the mind of Christ in that Paul told me what he knew. So the Bible is the mind of Christ in that I have the truths that were revealed to Paul in the Bible. And then I also have the mind of Christ, if we wanted to describe it in terms of that receptivity to the truth, that spiritual ability to appraise and see the truth of the gospel. But I'm just thinking that phrase, the mind of Christ, in the context makes more sense in terms of what he's just been describing about, look, you know, yeah, we by ourselves, we don't know the hidden things, the things that God knows, the things that Christ knows, but I do, because that's what God has done for me. That's the spiritual thing that he has done. Okay.
Can you think of other places where Paul has used we to mean I? Like other letters, maybe?
Yeah, in his letters to the Corinthians, he does it not infrequently. 2 Corinthians is a really good example. The beginning of chapter 3 is probably the best example. Are we beginning to commend ourselves again? Or do we need, as some letters of commendation to you or from you, you are our letter, written in our hearts, known and read by all men. It's clear in this letter, again, that there are those in Corinth who are charging Paul with various things. It's Paul they're charging. I mean, it's him personally that they're charging. And he says various things about, you know, what I did. You know I said that I was going to come to you first and then, you know, go twice and so on. But now let me explain to you what my reasons were and what it was that I was doing. So he goes into this explanation about his motives, about his intentions, about the purity of his intentions as a one who proclaims the gospel and all that stuff. So when we come to chapter 3, are we beginning to commend ourselves again? Or do we need, as some, letters of commendation to you or from you? The issue, absolutely, it seems to me, has to be Paul himself. Not even the apostles. We couldn't make the we Paul and other apostles, because they're not accusing the other apostles of anything. They're accusing Paul. He's the one that they're challenging. So I would argue that's a pretty good example of that.
I'm studying 2 Corinthians. I question that because he starts out, Paul and Timothy are writing the letter. And a lot of it he's saying, we. And then he goes in that part where he's talking about, I did this.
Right.
And then he goes back to, are we beginning to commend ourselves again?
Right.
And that almost sounds to me like he is making a distinction between the I parts and the we parts.
Well,
I mean, this isn't like a big issue, but...
No, it's an important issue.
Well, I'm thinking
the question is, when he switches from I to we, is he doing it because more people have joined the group that he's talking about at that spot, or is it something else? Is it a stylistic kind of choice or something like that? If you want to argue that Timothy is included in the we in that section, I guess it would be all right. It's just that it seems to me that when he's talking about commending ourselves and all of that kind of stuff, and what he goes on to say about not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God, who also made us adequate as servants of a new covenant. I don't think he could make that statement for Timothy, if I'm understanding what he's arguing. It's Paul as an apostle who has been made adequate as a minister of the new covenant, as he's describing it. So the choice I face there is, does the switch from I to we indicate that more people have joined? But what I'm saying is, what's striking about that is that he can move from I to we, and yet the we seems to me, I can hardly find a way to understand it that can include anybody else, when it's his own actions that he's defending in the statement. So in that kind of setting, I would argue that's pretty good. But down to 12, having therefore such a hope, we use great boldness in our speech and are not as Moses, who used to put a veil over his face, and so on. The Therefore, since we have this ministry, as we receive mercy, we do not lose heart, but we have renounced the things hidden because of shame. But by the manifestation of truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God, we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus as Lord, and so on. For me, from beginning to end throughout there, all of those we's are, they are addressed, they are addressing the challenge that the Corinthians are making to Paul, that when he describes that challenge throughout the letter, is always a challenge to him personally. The challenge that he's not really an apostle, which they make later on in 2 Corinthians, it doesn't really seem to include anybody else. It's not a knock at Timothy, because Timothy's not claiming to be an apostle. So I'm still kind of inclined to go that way.
I see Paul going, never went anywhere by himself, but he always went with a team.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm seeing when he's saying, this is what we did, you know, you're written in our hearts. We as a team work together for you. Now, I may have been the main spokesman, and I'm the one who's the apostle, and these are my, you know, helpers, perhaps. But I guess I see the we as being we, the team, who all came together. I'm not saying it would be like all Christians or anything. I'm just seeing, like he says, who was preached to you by me and Silvanus and Timothy.
Right.
So it sounds like all three of them preached Christ together when they went to Corinth. So I guess I'm seeing that little group, you know, as sort of being the we.
Well, certainly that's possible. I mean, I'm not denying that that's possible. What I would deny is that we Christians makes any sense in that section. And I guess it's just a question of your judgment of how that stuff fits together. But when I look at the nature of the things that he is saying about the we throughout there, it still looks to me like it's the things that are being said about him that are included. Like I say, he's defending his apostleship to those who are challenging it. It gets a little tricky to say, well, we, you know, I and my team, I mean, what exactly would he be saying about that? It's that what sort of adequacy have they been given as a team? Is the challenging Paul's apostleship reflect on the team? Or I'm not quite sure how to put that together.
Let me kind of broaden this a little bit, because as you were talking, even before Kate talked about this, Paul, I do see what you're saying about the eyes in here, because he even goes on about visions and everything. It's really interesting, but where it almost becomes a very personal type thing to him, something that obviously no one else experienced, and so on. But Paul had very close ties, obviously, with Antioch. And Antioch obviously recognized him as being called of God. And there was a prophecy, a prophet who actually prophesied over him that he was going to do this and so on and so forth. And then then they laid hands on him and they actually sent him out. So when he says we, it seems to me that he would be actually not only bearing the authority in Jesus himself, but also in the ministry that was bestowed upon him by the Holy Spirit and being confirmed by Antioch, by the men in Antioch, as far as the prophets and the laying on of hands and all of that.